Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the Hoops High Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Scotto. While the NBA playoffs begin in the bubble, we caught up with Hawks coach Lloyd Pierce to discuss life outside the bubble, his relationship with Trae Young, and free agency for Atlanta. We also touched on some other topics, including whether his former players Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid can coexist long-term with the 76ers. We also discussed some Steve Nash college stories from their days together at Santa Clara that you won't want to miss. While recording the episode, Jim Boylan was fired by the Chicago Bulls, so Pierce gave his reaction to that on the spot as well. Take a listen to that and much more. Lloyd, it's always great to chat with you. For you and the Hawks right now, what have you guys been doing outside the NBA bubble right now on a daily basis as you get ready for next season?
Depends on which month you're speaking of. No, I appreciate you having me on. The this is a very unusual time for anyone, but specifically with regards to us in basketball and not being in Orlando and our season being cut short, it's the most time we've all been away from basketball collectively and individually. So it took us 2 months to really figure out what was going to happen. And then when Georgia opened up, quote unquote, opened up, and the NBA started allowing teams to allow players back in the facility, we've been working since May 8th, and we've had guys, a good number of our guys in our facility consistently from May 8th on. And it's been 45 minutes on the court for a couple weeks, and then it transitioned to 45 minutes on the court and 45 minutes in the weight room. And we've kind of maintained that schedule since May 8th. We've given a couple weeks here and there for mental and physical breaks. But for the most part, I've been encouraged and proud of our guys. The guys that have been here in Atlanta that have been doing that on a very consistent basis. It's not easy. It's not fun. There's no versatility, but they have been diligent.
You talked about mental breaks and whatnot. For you and for the players, what has it been like for you guys to get back in the gym at all for your own mental health and psyche during these uncertain times?
Well, it's the closest thing we have to normalcy. And I say that simply by saying to be able to wake up and have something on your agenda that requires you to get out of the house is about as close to normal as we can make it. And so for our coaches specifically, you know, those guys are able to come in and be in the gym for 3 hours, 4 hours at times. And that's normal. That's kind of what we're used to. And we've been away. We were away from it for about 2 months. So it just feels good to come in the gym. You know, we're wearing masks. We're wearing the gloves. There is no contact, but we're in the gym. And I think that feels great. It breaks up the day. It gives us something to look forward to. But it also keeps us connected and bonded with our guys as well.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting was because you guys have had to use Zoom for a decent amount of that time, especially earlier in the pandemic, you've brought on some guest speakers on video, like former coaches and other professions like John Gruden, Tony Dungy, Herm Edwards, and I think even Tony Ressler at one point addressed you guys. What was the thought process in getting those guys on a video chat to talk to your young squad?
Well, there's so much going on in our world. And I'm a curious learner, curious thinker, or at least I think of myself as one. I'm always trying to figure out ways to connect with different people of different sectors and just learn, just listen. So this time has given us an opportunity to really do that. As a team, but as a staff and for myself. And I just wanted to try and make every meeting and every opportunity that we had with our players, somewhat enlightening, keep it keep it fun, keep it educational, keep it informative, but be different. So we meet, for the most part, we've been meeting twice a week on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 5 p.m. And we're going to take a break on that until mid-September at the earliest. But, you know, each week it's hard to find what to talk about. So thought it'd be cool to have some fun and bring some different guests on. And you know, everybody's living on Zoom now, so it actually hasn't been that hard to get the amount of guests that we've had from the coaches in the NFL that you've mentioned. Tony's been on. He's been on a number of our meetings, you know, as a guest speaker, just to catch up or as a listener to some of our other guest speakers. He's been a part of the meetings as well. We've had Chris Tucker, Spice Adams, Ernie Johnson, Mayor Keisha Bottoms here in Atlanta, Stacey Abrams. So it's been fun. It's been educational. You know, Grant Hill takes in some of the meetings as well as one of our minority owners. So it's been good. It keeps us connected. It keeps us educated, and it keeps the meetings unpredictable, which I think is really the greatest challenge of it all.
You've got quite a Rolodex there, and I know for you being an Oakland Raiders fan, I'm sure it was good to have John Gruden on. And you talk about
Las Vegas Raiders fan now.
Oh, so you're making the switch. Okay.
Oh, without a doubt. I'm a Raider fan, and first and foremost, that's what it's always about.
How did you feel when they moved?
Just win, baby. Doesn't matter.
Simple enough and well said indeed on that one, Lloyd. You know, you also talked about, you know, what can you talk about during these times? And for you individually, you wrote on the Players Tribune about becoming an activist and whatnot, and being in Atlanta specifically, what have you talked with your players about regarding the Black Lives Movement, stuff going on in the country right now during the protests and the pandemic, during this critical time in our nation's history?
You know, a lot, really. We've had some good conversations. We've had some emotional conversations. We've had some good open dialogue. I did forget to mention one other person that's been on our calls, and that was Junior Bridgman. And I feel bad for not mentioning it, because that was probably one of our better calls, just the enlightenment and education he gave us as a former NBA player in the financial world and business world, which was really great for our guys to hear. But no, the conversations off the court have been plenty. You know, we've talked a lot about, you know, my feelings and how I felt initially when the George Floyd incident occurred and the Amy Cooper incident occurred in New York in the park. And then we talked about what I felt was needed, which is to be open, to be vulnerable, and not afraid to express frustration, anger, fear, concerns that I have as a Black man. And you know, we have a team that's predominantly Black, with the exception of Kevin Herter, but it's also been an extremely enlightening and educational period for him. And so the conversation has really surfaced around what's going on in our country. And it's just, you know, it's gone a few different places. Now, our guys aren't extremely vocal, but they're smart and they're high character guys, and they're listening and they're learning and they're understanding, and they're trying to figure out, you know, all of this, as we all are at the same time. So I just felt like it'd be great to have some conversations about what the players in the bubble are doing and what our guys think, and take it from there, as if we were there and we were in that position, what would we do kind of scenarios. But also just speaking openly about, you know, just real stuff, equality, racism, systemic racism, politics. That's why we had Mayor Keisha and Stacey Abrams on, to really educate us about voting. understand politics a little bit. Not, you know, we didn't go into every policy or everything of that nature, but just a little bit of what they do and some of the challenges that they have, and what we should be doing with our platform as athletes and coaches and the league. So, you know, it's been good to just have those conversations and hopefully keep those conversations going as we move forward.
You talked about those conversations with your guys and your young group at that. You've also become an NBA committee leader on racial justice and reform and within the coaching community, and you've gotten a group together with, you know, let me know if I miss any names, but from what I recall, Steve Kerr, Quinn Snyder, Greg Popovich, Doc Rivers, Brett Brown, J.B. Bickerstaff with Cleveland, and former coaches Stan Van Gundy and David Fizdale. What is your goal with that committee, and to maybe educate the fellow coaches that you have in your profession?
Well, I mean, we're basically, we're all in it together. And so it's really every coach. It isn't just a committee. It's all 30 of our coaches and the former coaches, Stan and Mike Brown and Dave Fizdale and Kenny Atkinson. All of those guys have been active in our meetings as well. The committee was really just kind of the brainstorming group that we could meet a little more often and share some ideas about what we can do as coaches to really rally each other and educate our players about steps, conversations, education, the necessary dialogue that we need to have to be a part of the solution, to be a part of the change, to use our platform with proper context. And so we've really just tried to commit ourselves to connecting with the right people, connecting with organizations both nationally and locally, and really trying to blend our resources, our access, their information, their knowledge, and put together a plan that can enact change in 30 NBA cities and be a model as an organization of coaches and players and ownership and league of what we want to see our country look like. You know, the ability to coexist in a way that is necessary, the way we have to in sport, is really our goal. How do we bridge the gap in our community so that police and young people of color don't feel like they're aliens to one another and they can't communicate, and communication doesn't have to lead to arrests or death all the time? And so what can we do to be a part of that change, to be a part of those solutions, to create tough conversations? That's what we're focused on, and that's what that committee has been charged with, connecting with people that can give us greater insight on how to do that, how to go about doing that.
Well, to that end, we've certainly seen some of those guys that we talked about, you know, especially Pop, Doc Rivers, talk about things going on in society and during press conferences, and they haven't just been, oh, let's talk about a basketball game. There has been a bigger picture outlook here. Speaking of coaches, I don't know if you had seen this yet as we're taping this pod right now, but Jim Boylan was let go from the Bulls. Anytime a coaching brethren of yours gets let go, there are only 30 jobs. It's such a unique job to have in this world. What goes through your mind when you see that, when someone else gets let go?
You know, you have to look at it from both sides. And for me, it's disturbing. It's upsetting. You know, Jim's a great man. I know the challenges that he was facing as a coach with a team that's similarly young to ours, and trying to get that thing going. It's not easy. It's not always the easiest task at hand when you're dealing with the media, the social media, young players, and then the expectations of everyone. Everyone wants to win, and everyone wants to win right now. So I know the position. I'm in the position. But we all know, as coaches, we all know that this is the job that we're in, and we understand the expectations that come with the job. We understand the seriousness of those expectations, and we take on the task knowing that. So, I think Jim will be fine. He'll land on his feet soon. He was granted a great opportunity, and I hope nothing but the best for him. But I also understand that this is our business. So, it's just it is what it is sometimes like that.
You talked about a little bit of social media and the effect of having to win and being tasked with the rebuilding project. Previously, before you came to Atlanta, you dealt with that very situation with the Philadelphia 76ers before Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid really morphed into the players that they are now. It seems, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems now more than ever, it's important for a coach to have a really good relationship with his star player. And for you, that guy is Trae Young. He took the step this year to become an all-star player. How would you describe your relationship with Trae and the balancing act of coaching an all-star, particularly in today's NBA?
The balancing act is the job. It's you want to be able to connect with all of your players. You definitely need to connect with your star player. But you also have to balance the challenge of connecting with and coaching up. I feel when you take on young players similar to what we had in Philly and obviously what we have here in Atlanta, when you're coaching young players, your commitment to their development and growth is on and off the court. Trae's at an age, I think he's 21, maybe turning 22 next month in September, I believe is his birthday. He's at an age where he's coming into his own, not only as a player, but as a man, buying houses for the first time, being on his own, financial security, all of those things are happening at once. And I definitely want to be a part of him understanding, how to balance work, play, social life as a star player. He's a star player. He's the face of a franchise right now. He's an all-star in his second year. He's headed for greatness. And you want to be able to challenge him to achieve all of those things seamlessly, if possible. And when those bumps in the road occur, be able to handle them accordingly. And so, it isn't just about having a great relationship. It's having an honest relationship. It's having a relationship of trust. And I tell all my players, I hope none of you guys trust me when we meet each other. I hope you all trust me as we go through everything, because you can see the commitment that I have to their development, and you can see the commitment that I have to their growth. And that's where the trust should come from. It shouldn't just come from the fact that I'm the head coach. I need to earn it, and I need to earn it by being truthful, honest, committed to their development. And so our relationship has been just that, trying to help him grow, trying to help him see things that maybe he doesn't see, and then trying to help him apply things that we want to see in the future of leadership, of advancement, things of that nature. And so that's really where our relationship is. We're at this period where we're trying to form this partnership. We're trying to grow this partnership because our goals are aligned. We want to win. We want greatness. We want it sooner than later. But we also know we got to go through the necessary rigors and steps as an organization, as a team, and for him as a player, without skipping those steps or trying to advance too quickly. And it's been great because he has advanced fairly quickly, but I think he's taken the necessary steps as well.
I think back to when I was 21 and you know, I was graduating Hofstra University at the time, and for you, you were probably getting out of Santa Clara at the time. To have the responsibility that he has at such a young age, and as you mentioned, being the face of a franchise, it's certainly a lot to ask for a 21-year-old young man and growing into that as a person. You also touched on the social media aspect of being a head coach. I know you have a Twitter account. You're on there. You see some of the stuff that gets mentioned. How does social media affect you as a head coach on a day-to-day basis?
Not one bit.
You don't look at it at all, or you hear any of the noise?
No, I look at it. It doesn't affect me. I don't have thin skin. I'm fine. I'm on social media because I choose to, and I use it the way I want to. I actually like criticism. I actually like controversy. I'm good. For me, and I tell our guys this all the time, I tell our local media this all the time, This is basketball. This comes with the territory. You go into the barbershop, guys in my barbershop, they kill me. Hey, coach, what's going on, coach? You know, as soon as I walk in. I grew up on that. That's easy. You know, but if you bring it to me, expect it back. You know, we've had season ticket holder events and post-game events where I'm meeting with the fans. The season ticket holder events are great because it's like, you know, they're at Topgolf and they're at a brewery, they're at different events, and people get a couple drinks in them and they, hey, coach, can I ask you a question? Sure, go ahead. And so, you know, you ask candidly, I'm going to answer candidly. And I think the respect is grown, especially when you can have interaction with someone. But on social media, I don't interact with everyone. But I'm also not going to shy away from the fact that someone's going to be critiquing everything that I do. That comes with the territory. I'm good. I got no problem with that. I go on social media and I critique all the politicians and all the stupid stuff I see as well. You know, I try and keep it to my own thoughts. I don't really send it over the waves too much, but it's natural. It's what we do. And as a head coach, even if I didn't see it, I know it's out there, and it still wouldn't bother me. It still doesn't bother me because it is just sport. It is just basketball. I think 2020, if any year, has shown us, you know, basketball. There's greater things in life that we have to and should be concerned about. Basketball is our escape. It's what we do. It's a way of life. It's been very transformative for me and the opportunities that it's given me. But it's just basketball. When you're talking about this virus, you're talking about the racial injustice, you're talking about inequalities that we have in our country, those things really bother me. Those things concern me. Those are the things that get under my skin. Those are the things that I'm really committed to speaking up on and speaking out against. The basketball stuff, I embrace it. I love it.
Well said. As someone who talks to their barber when I'm getting a haircut, I can only imagine if they give you maybe a shorter buzz that way, because they're getting either a little heated in a conversation or whatnot. I don't know if I'd have that conversation in the chair like you are, but I respect it.
It's all out of respect. I think, I think when you can go back and forth with someone, mm-hmm. and this is competition, you know, if I go to the barbershop, and those are my guys, so they'll come in and they say, man, coach, y'all didn't have it last night. What was up with that? You know, I'm not an excuse guy. I'm not going to give them any excuses. I'm just going to take it. But I think, you know, when the tables turn, they're also going to be the same people that's going to say, coach, man, I got to give you credit. You know, we stuck with you. You stuck with it. And, you know, everything worked out. And I think critics understand that, too. Some people are just going to hate to hate. I can't control that. But I think some people want to critique because they want a challenge. They want to see the challenge. They want to see things change. And they're going to critique until they are. And then when things do change, passionate fans are loyal. Passionate fans will speak up and say, hey, you know, we were wrong, but we're glad you stuck with it. So that's sport. That's just how it is.
What did you take away from this season in particular? Because, you know, John Collins got his suspension earlier in the season, and then you guys, in an effort to get better, you make the trade for Clint Capela, who's a younger guy that can help you win games, but he didn't get to play for you guys. And you mentioned the younger guys like Kevin Herter as part of the core earlier, and you have other younger guys even than Kevin in Cam Reddish and DeAndre Hunter that you just brought into from the draft class. So what did you make of this year for this Hawks team?
Well, I mean, you mentioned a few things, and of those few things, you know, that's what happens in sport. You end up with a suspension. You end up with a trade and a player is injured. You end up with, and this is not in sport, this is in society, you end up with a shortened season. But for me, it's my second year. And when you're building through the draft and you bring on a lot of young guys, and you know, these are the necessary steps that we chose to take as an organization. These are some of the things you have to and do go through. Do you want to? No, no one wants to go through injuries and suspensions. But in sport, things happen. And for us, those are the things that happen. I think for the most part, when we were healthy, when we were at as close to full capacity as we could be, man, it was fun and really promising and encouraging to see what our guys are capable of doing. But as in sport, part of the challenge is maintaining that consistency to get on the court and then maintaining that consistency on the court. And so we're encouraged. We feel, you know, if some luck comes our way and our guys are all healthy, our guys are all together for a long period of time, we'll be fine with the stuff that we can control. The stuff that we can't control that comes our way, we have to work through. And we were able to work through some of that this year. And I think you saw Trey's development because we were shorthanded. And so he put more on his shoulders and he can handle more. And then when John came back, he had a lot to prove, and he did. He averaged 21-10 on 40% from three and 80% from the line and almost 60% from the field. And when Cam and DeAndre got their opportunities early, they were overwhelmed. But because of those opportunities, they also were able to grow throughout the year, and they're pretty seasoned as first year players with the amount of minutes that they were able to play. And so you go through each guy and you say, we'll be all right, because each guy got an opportunity to grow. But in sport, there's always going to be some adverse times and adverse situations. We went through a bunch of it this year. I'm not holding that back. That's just what happens. If that's the luck of the draw for me, then, you know, I just got dealt a bad hand. I got a great hand. I got a great hand to young guys. I'm very encouraged by those young guys. I can't wait for us all to be together, because I think we can do something really special with this group.
I think you certainly know what you got in Trey as an all-star caliber guy and face of the franchise. John, you talked about it, 20-10. You could book it. Even Clint Capela, you know, he's a shot blocker, good rim roller, and a more proven young guy. I think it's going to be interesting to see how Kevin Herter develops, DeAndre Hunter. And for me in particular, Cam Reddish, because when I look at him physically, he has physical tools that you can't teach, and you as a coach can't teach. You then have that physical talent that you can mold. He's a guy that I'm in particularly curious to see where he goes next season and beyond, because I think he has the upside.
Yeah, I call Cam, when he's out there on the court, I call him Cam, and I won't cuss on your show, but the first word starts mother. Cam mother effing Reddish, because I think he's a bad man, and I think he's really going to turn out to be something extremely special, and I want him to have the toughest mentality. I want him to think he's the greatest player in the NBA. I want him to believe it, because he's got an opportunity with his potential, his skill set, his size, his confidence. He's got an opportunity to really do something special. So I'm trying to really bring that out of him, because I do. I think you're spot on with that. He's a young guy. He's only 20 years old. It's scary. It's scary to think he's only 20 years old. You know, but we all want it now. We all want it now, and that's the challenge. But I'm going to be patient with him, but I'm also going to challenge him to get the most out of everything that he has, and we want to try and get the most out of him.
Crazy to think the guy can't even buy a beer and he's playing in the NBA. It shows where the league is headed and whatnot. But, you know, another part of your job is the constant communication you have with your GM, Travis Schlenk, and your owner, Tony Rezzo. That's also a part of the job that I don't know if the average fan necessarily comprehends. For you, how often are you in conversations with Travis and even your owner, Tony Rezzo?
Travis and I speak, you know, I always say 2-minute conversations. We have short conversations probably daily. You know, he'll send me a joke, something, you know, talking to one of our players or former players or another agent, or, you know, he'll send his joke my way and I'll send my complaint or criticism his way one day, and we'll laugh everything off, or we'll just strategize on, you know, what we should be doing right now. We talk on everything. They're just kind of, hey, just so you know, I was able to speak to such and such, you know, and I think the strength of our relationship has been that we kind of keep each other up to date on both of our worlds, because they're all going to overlap. You know, if I need to know something about Kevin Herter and Travis got the information from his agent, it's a good heads up for me and vice versa. And I think it's a really positive relationship to have. So no one's really ever caught off guard. Hey, how did you know about this? Yeah, I did. Well, why didn't you share it? Now I felt caught off. You know what I mean? Like it's been great that we can have those short conversations and often conversations about, you know, where our guys are, what we should be doing, what we're planning, what some thoughts may be down the line. And it's also good because of the understanding of who we are as an organization and team in year two going into year three. Having that vertical alignment with Travis, with Tony, that we can relate to our players about where we are, what our plans are, what we should be doing, what we're thinking. I think that's a sign of a healthy and a positive organization. So everybody's on the same page. And if someone is ready to move in a different direction, at least it's communicated and thought about and talked about. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that thus far.
Do you give Travis...
Tony and I... Travis and Tony obviously speak more, kind of a diverse conversation. It's not just the team, you know, more about the organization, the team, the everything, especially with the coronavirus, the safety issues, things of that nature. So their conversations are a little more diverse. Tony, Travis, myself, Grant Hill, we meet every other Wednesday, for about an hour over Zoom, and we just catch up on all things basketball specifically and anything else that may come up. And again, that's that vertical alignment, just making sure we're on the same page, we're communicating, you know, where we are, what are our next steps, what should we be thinking about, what should we be doing. And they're healthy conversations. They're not meant to be, hey, everybody listen to one person and that person's right, and they're meant to, you know, challenge this notion and share this notion. And then Tony and I have been, we've had some great conversations with our CEO and our community relations team about a lot of the off court and the racial injustice issues and things that we should be doing as an organization here in the city to get involved and try to understand what that involvement might actually look like or mean. And so that's been a separate meeting that we've also had that I'm in communication with Tony on.
Do you give Travis kind of a wish list as a head coach of what you think you guys could use to help the team get better as you head into next season?
Yeah, definitely. I think you have to look at it with a very understandable lens. I never say, hey, get rid of this guy, or, you know, if I don't like a guy, I'll tell him I don't like a guy. If I do like a guy, I'll tell him I like a guy. But really, for me, it's just some of the things you may not be aware of that I feel are important in our locker room is where I try and lend my greatest value. You know, we need leadership. We need a older guy, whatever it may be. You know, I don't say who that guy is, but I say, here's an example of what we need. I think he and his staff do a tremendous job of gathering information, of meeting consistently and discussing intel about the free agents, the players in our league, the draft prospects, and trying to identify who those guys could potentially be down the line. And so I do, you know, I offer what I can, but I also am mindful that I'm not watching such and such from the other team on a consistent basis. I'm only watching them when we scout them and trying to figure out how to minimize their effectiveness on the court. But I don't know about their relationships with their coaches and what their coaches are saying. That's what our scouts and his staff, they do a tremendous job of going around and gathering that information and then sharing it as a group so that we have education and properly guided when it's time to make a transaction or a move moving forward.
No doubt intel in the NBA is the highest currency, without a doubt. And, you know, you mentioned about veterans and guys in the locker room. You've had a couple of guys. You had Vince Carter, Jeremy Lin, just from my perspective, that come to mind that I thought had a good impact on some of your younger guys. I always kind of joke that I felt like Vince was almost like a player coach as he was into his 40s. And you know, Jay Lynn's effect on Trae Young before he ended up going his separate ways, we've seen it in year two, how he grew. What do you think is the next step for the Hawks next season? I know that's a general question, but I'm curious your opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very general, but it's also specific. I think the biggest thing for me is our growth is going to be dependent on our young guys getting better, and every guy. And that includes Trae and John. But specifically speaking about Trae and John being better, and I don't know what better exactly means. You know, it's not a number thing. I don't look at it as a number thing, and I hate that people evaluate our guys or any guy in the league in sport on numbers. If Trae's numbers go down next year and we're tremendously better, he's probably a lot better. You know, and I think all of our guys, our young guys, because they're a major part of what we've built, they need to be better. And then we have to add some veteran, some rotational, some professional depth and experience to complement our young guys. Because we have 9 guys, I believe, under contract right now, so roster spots to fill. And to do that and to make the next step, to have some NBA experience in our locker room, some high character experience in our locker room, and some leadership in our locker room to help those young guys get better, but also to bring it. You know, you're looking at the Toronto Raptors and the Milwaukee Bucks and the LA Clippers and the Denver Nuggets, who have tremendous depth and options, and we want to be in that same category. We want to make a huge jump next year. We want to be in that same category, and so we've got to add some guys that can come in and contribute right away. But we also have a draft pick, a high draft pick. We've got a guy like Bruno Fernando that we still will develop, and as we continue to grow, they can be a part of our growth. Not necessarily just right now, but also guys that we can see come into this thing 2-3 years down the line and really be ready to make positive contributions.
Bruno, good young man, and certainly a guy that can be a rotation big in the NBA. From my opinion, he's got all the physical tools. One thing I think also is part of your job is getting guys up for these on a normal circumstance, you know, non-COVID related. I always think of those weekend afternoon games when guys would come into either like MSG or Barclays. And for me, I jokingly call them the hangover games because, you know, for a lot of guys that come into a big city, they might try to go out the night before. And I'm not saying your guys specifically because they're a little younger. And first of all, some of them can't even get into a 21 and over club, which is kind of funny when you think about it. But do you ever get a sense that it is harder for guys to get up for those early afternoon games? And how do you keep them sharp for those type of early games when they're used to playing at 7 o'clock or later at night?
No, you know, it's hard to, everybody's on a different schedule in their careers. Our young guys openly discuss how tough the second night of a back-to-back is. They just, you know, have not experienced that, have not experienced the routine of handling, you know, the preparation for the second game. And, you know, it was good. I think it's good experience. That's why playing those young guys early is important. So they learn second nights are tough. And so it's the same goes for early afternoon game on the road. You know, it's a different experience. You get into the city, you may get there late. You may get there, especially in New York. You know, you think you're getting there at 4:30. By the time you get through the tunnel and across the bridge into the city and deal with traffic, by the time you check into your hotel, it might be 6:30 or 7. And everybody wants to go to dinner or shop or do whatever they do in New York. But that's part of the growing experience of playing in the NBA. Some guys end up preferring to play early. It becomes their favorite game time. So, you know, there's nothing I can do to really help facilitate that routine. I think you just have to go through it a few times and understand, oh man, afternoon game, you know, I got to make sure I wake up earlier this time and, you know, go to dinner immediately the night before and not wait till 10 o'clock and get the late dinner slot. You know, things of that nature is what people start to figure out, and they just have to go through it. That's the bottom line.
For you individually, what's a game day like for you schedule-wise? What time are you getting up, and how do you break down the day leading up to tip-off?
Well, I'm the same every day. You know, my clock is usually around 6:45. Doesn't matter if I go to sleep at midnight, which I never do, or 2 a.m., which I commonly do often. So I'm usually up. My clock is usually right. I don't use an alarm clock. So I'm just up. I'm up at 6:45. I've never used an alarm clock in the NBA. I'm just up. You know, if we have a staff meeting, let's say we have shoot around, we're on the road. We have shoot around at 10, and we're probably leaving the hotel at 9:30. We typically do our meetings an hour or an hour and 15 before the bus leaves. So that's an 8:15 meeting or an 8 a.m. meeting or 8:30 meeting, somewhere in that range. I try and get work started an hour before the meeting. And so work for me is go get my Starbucks and get my sorters, my video sorters in order and organized and prepared for the meeting. You know, the flight over the day before is where I get a lot of the work done. And then the morning of the day, the game is where I kind of organize all of the thoughts and the sorters and the questions that I may have for whoever is doing the scout that day. You know, shoot around. What we do with shoot around, we just put 75 minutes on the clock. So from the time we touch the floor, we're done 75 minutes. And that includes whatever amount of video we want to show, whatever amount of time we're going to be on the court. We try and do that at home and away, 75 minutes max. And then, you know, on the road, I normally try and get a little bit of outside in, whether it's to go, if I'm in New York, I always go shopping or just get out and walk around. But I always try and just walk around somewhere for a little bit. I normally get a quick workout in before the bus. I'm on the second bus to the arena, so I normally get a quick workout in and then change, headed to the bus. Half of the year, I was wearing sweats to the arena. Second half of the year, I just started wearing the suit, the pants and shirt to the arena, just to change it up. then I get to the arena and I basically just kind of unwind a little bit. I read on the bus to the arena to get away from basketball, you know, 20, 30 minutes. And then I do all my game prep. You know, what offense can we run against these guys? What are some of the ATOs I need to prepare for? And, you know, what are they going to run late game is what I try and focus on before our team meeting.
That's certainly a full day. I know it's 6:45. I hope I'm sleeping and I'm counting sheep at that point. But, you know, maybe get up a little bit after that. But it's a full day for a coach, and I appreciate you sharing that perspective. I don't think,
I think a lot of people realize that. Some people, you know, that might be a late day for a lot of coaches.
I know Kenny Atkinson used to tell me sometimes 4:30 in the morning he'd be up. When he was here in Brooklyn, depending on whatnot, especially as he was trying to get the group going early. So yeah, for it seems like a lot of coaches, you guys are early bird gets the worm saying and whatnot. I was curious too.
I've always been the opposite. I can't go to sleep early. You know, Brett Brown, when I was in Philly, he was always the first person to the practice facility. You know, he'd get there as early as 6:30, something like that as well. But I know he was an early sleeper. I'm not an early sleeper. You know, you wake up and you got about three messages from Brett already because, you know, he's up early and he's already in his car and he's already at the facility. But you can't hit him past 10 at night because he's knocked out. So he's not getting it in the morning. I'm doing a lot of my work from 10 to 2 a.m. and watching the West Coast games as well. So, you know, as long as you get your work done, I think that's kind of a common thread in the NBA. You know, most head coaches don't micromanage too much. We're always on top of stuff, but I think we empower our assistants to do great work. But everybody has a different routine. And my mind happens to be, I am a late night worker, and I still am somewhat of an early morning guy. I don't sleep. I can go. So I don't need sleep. I don't get a lot of sleep. I just make sure I get my stuff done, and I'm willing to stay up late, and willing to get up early if I have to. But I kind of know my routine. I'm kind of confident in my routine.
You brought up Brett Brown, and you think of the 76ers now. They're in the playoffs. When you hear people talk about whether Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid can coexist together, you coach these guys. What do you think of that? And when people wonder if they have to maybe trade one of those guys to balance out a team, what do you think?
I think it's blasphemy. I think in this league, I think in sport, you know, the challenge is, can you win? Let's just start there. Can you win? Are you a winner? Can you win? Can you do what you need to do to impact winning? If you are that guy, it doesn't matter who you play with. It shouldn't matter who you play with. You know, winners get extra rebounds. Winners run the floor. Winners attack. Winners defend. Winners compete. To think you have a top 10, top 15 talent player, and you have two, and they can't coexist. To me, that's someone's not impacting winning. I think they both impact winning. I think they're both capable of impacting winning. I think they want to. So I'm not getting rid of one to go find another, because you might not find another. It's hard to find top 15 talent that impacts winning and is competitive. And both of those guys, I think, have shown that. And they were, a basket away from going to the conference finals last year. You know, I think chemistry is real. You have to have team chemistry. You have to develop it. You have to continue to work at it. But impacting winning and competing is real as well. And I think both of those guys had that. And, you know, I'm more concerned with how do you make it work, not let's get rid of it and try another route. I don't really agree with that approach for any team.
That's a great point. If Kawhi Leonard doesn't make that shot and it bounces, first of all, the shot seemed to defy the laws of physics, but we're not here to talk about that on the pod. But that bounce was ridiculous. And then now you got Ben out. You know, you hear Brett Brown. Oh, it always seems like this guy's on the hot seat in a way, because they have such high expectations for those young guys. I think the chemistry you talked about is definitely important. One thing I had to ask you before I let you go. You played with Steve Nash and I believe your assistant coach, Marlon Garnett, back at Santa Clara. What is the best Steve Nash college story you have, whether it was going out somewhere or something that somebody may not know about the former two-time MVP? I always found that cool that you guys all played together in college.
He's a big Nas fan. I think some people may know that, but you know, he was always a big Nas, Illmatic fan. That was kind of our generation, our timeline back then, when we were in college together. He and his roommates had the best college parties. They lived at a place called the Firehouse or Fireplace, whatever it was called, but it's the best place to go and party after a game. And, you know, the best story I can give you, though, is really, for me, we were playing at Gonzaga. I think it was his junior year, might be his senior year. And I want to say it was a deciding game for conference, winner wins conference. And it was the old Kennel, so it was kind of the high school gym that they had back then, before they built the new arena. And we go up, you know, Gonzaga, they have their fans there, you know, 2 hours before the game because they want to create a hostile environment. First come, first serve. And so it's packed when we get off the bus. They're already in the cheering section. The cheering section goes as close to the court as you could possibly imagine. And Nash, we go out there shooting early, and he goes right over to that side of the court where the cheering section is, and he just drains jumper after jumper on that side. He doesn't move around. He just stays right on that side, and they're giving it to him, yelling all kind of stuff about him, Canada, CBA. They were saying he was going to be a CBA player at the time. And I think he has 5 points at halftime. And, you know, it's a tight ball game. He has 5 points at halftime. We end up winning in overtime. He ends up with 40. And it was truly one of the best performances I've ever seen. I mean, the guy just completely took over the game in the second half and in overtime. We come back, we win. But this is from a guy that had 5 points at halftime. We ends up with 40. And it was amazing. It was an amazing game. But it was kind of like he embraced that atmosphere. He embraced that pressure. He embraced that criticism. And he just held on to it.
And it was in that moment that you said to yourself, he's going to be a two-time MVP in the NBA, I'm sure.
No, but you never said that. You just knew he was good. You knew he was different. I knew he was different the first time I played with him. I didn't know how different. But I knew he was different. His handle, his hand-eye IQ, his hand-eye coordination, his IQ, his ability to just shoot the basketball. You know, all of it was there. He's just a very cerebral, skilled player that could shoot. And you knew he was a pro. You knew he was a pro. You knew he was a first-round pro by the time he was all said and done at Santa Clara. And then when he got to the NBA, you know, the glimpses he had, you knew he was going to be a good player. And then it just went to a different level, and I don't think anyone saw that coming.
Well, I'd say it worked out for Steve. I'd say it worked out for you and your other teammate, Marlon, who's an assistant coach on your staff. Lloyd, we've covered a wide variety of topics. I certainly appreciate you coming on. It was a lot of fun. Hopefully we'll get to do it again.
I appreciate it. Yep, thanks for having me on, Mike.
If you want to hear more episodes of the Hoops High Podcast, like and subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. You can also keep up with my tweets on Twitter at Mike A. Scotto. Until next time, I'm your host, Michael Scotto, wishing you and yours all the best.